Welcome to Stage and Studio. I'm James Dixon. On today's show, our special guest, writer, teacher, therapist, lobbyist, and actress, Dana Schaefer. Today, we discuss her one-woman show, You in Mid-Air, a mother's show about the ultimate loss, directed by Julie Akers, and being produced at New Expressive Works. Previously titled My Little Jezebel, this full production follows a January 2017 staged reading with PDX Playwrights and the Fertile Ground Festival New Works. Dana is not only the performer of this piece, but also the playwright, and this will be its Portland debut. Stay with us and join the discussion with Stage and Studio.
I'm like an ocean wave that's bumped on the shore. I feel so absolutely stumped on the floor.
I'm James Dixon. Joining me in the KBOO studio today, we have special guest, writer, teacher, therapist, lobbyist, and actress, Dana Schaefer.
Oh, I see. She's like, oh, I'm not that special. Yes, you are. Today, we discuss her one-woman show, You in Mid-Air, which is being produced at New Expressive Works. Dana, welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thank you so much. Can I tell you why I was laughing?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you called me an actor, I think, or actress. And there was a piece in Artslandia on our producer, Howie Bierbaum, and in the interview, he said that he was working with Portland playwright and actress Dana Schaefer. I've never been an actress before, so I went to Ben's. I said, he called me an actress.
You're it.
I guess I am. It's pretty exciting.
You're it. I actually had the same thing. I've been acting for 3.5 years, and I didn't start calling myself an actor until my third show.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
So give yourself permission.
All right.
Give yourself permission, because we're throwing our hands into the fire, and we're going to talk about this amazing show that you've put together. So Dana, you've been based in Portland for how long now?
We moved here from Eugene in 1980. Rebecca was 14, and since 1980, long time.
And before we dive into the show, can you tell us about Rebecca?
Rebecca was a beautiful little girl, and we thought she was shy. And then one day when she was 11, one morning, the mother of one of her friends called one Saturday morning and said, that little daughter of yours is a hell of an actress. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, the sixth grade did a production of Free to Be You and Me last night, and Rebecca was one of the newborn babies trying to decide what gender she is, and she was hilarious. And we thought she spent the night at a friend's house. And later I said to her, honey, why didn't you tell us that you were doing this? And she said, I was too busy running lines with my scene partner. So then she started acting, and then she got herself to New York via modeling, and then she started getting acting gigs in New York, and she got a part in a Woody Allen movie, and she went out for a sitcom in New York, and they called her back, flew her to L.A., and she starred in a sitcom for 2 years, and then an obsessed fan one morning rang her doorbell. She was expecting a script to be delivered for Godfather 3. She was going to go out for Godfather 3, and the doorbell rang. The guy rang the doorbell, hid in the bushes. When she came to the door thinking it was the courier with the script, he jumped out and shot her and killed her. So that is, in very brief, my experience of Rebecca's life and death.
That's really hard to hear. I try to keep it professional with this type of thing, but I can't help but think about I lost a really dear friend a couple months ago.
Did you? Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did you lose the person?
My best friend, Jacob, was an amazing DJ, amazing dancer, and hairstylist here in Portland. He ran out of toilet paper, so he had to go get some more toilet paper, to get to the grocery store, drove home, and parked his car a block away, and then this guy picked him at random to be the person that he wanted to attack for the night. He picked 4 people, and Jacob was the
attacked
second.
Did you say with a knife?
With a knife. So he chased Jacob for about a block and a half to his apartment, and he was killed in the entryway of his apartment. This was back in May. He died on my birthday. Actually.
I am so sorry.
Thank you.
I am so sorry. And you know, that's... When I wrote the play, and I'm actually still rewriting it, I had to decide that this was going to be my story of my experience with Rebecca's life and death. And I'm so acutely aware of all the suffering around us. I mean, every day, how can you not be just sickened by all the tragedy, and I felt a little selfish talking about mine. Who do I think I am? And then I thought, well, you know, this is one story of the millions and millions every day, and I'm going to explain myself, you know.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I had a similar feeling when this happened. I was picked his mother up at the airport and drove her to the hospital. Mm. He's had no family here, and she knows no one here but him, so I decided to be her son for her now.
Fantastic.
And get her to the hospital to see my best friend.
It's so important.
And but, you know, I remember saying to myself, we are those people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see it on TV, you see it, and then you're that person.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are you those people, you're those people for the rest of your life.
Yeah, right.
Like, that's a moment in time. It's really, it's just, I don't know. I was affected by it. But I'm so glad that you're doing this, because when this happened with my friend, I was about 3 days, had 3 days left in a run I was doing. I was doing a maze at Theater Vertigo.
Hmm.
And at 3 days left in a run.
Oh, gee.
And he was still alive at that point. But I just remember putting on my costume, prepping myself and saying, this is, you take your heart and your mind, you take whatever, I don't know, you put it in a box, and sometimes you don't put it in a box.
That's right, yeah.
And you got to go out there, because you and I get to do this and they don't.
That's right.
Get to do this and they don't.
That's
and then you
exactly
take a breath
right.
And you go and you do
that's
it.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. And I remember to Benson often, and I say this in my piece, is it okay for us to have fun even though she can't? And then I think, I like to think of myself as her ambassador in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be her ambassador of fun, too, you know? I'm going to have fun, and I know she would want me to, and I don't even like to talk like that because I don't want to assume anything about what she might think, but, yeah, I think I like what you said.
Well, I'm here to let you know that your feelings or any feelings that you have are valid.
That's what my therapist said. Because, you know, I didn't have the anger, and she thought there was something wrong with me, but I got some grief for it. And she said, hey, whatever you go through, whatever you do, whenever you have whatever, and it sounds sort of obvious to us now, but I was really glad she said that.
Once again, for those that are just now joining us, you are listening to Stage and Studio. I'm James Dixon, and joining us today is our special guest, Dana Schaefer, writer and actress for her one-woman show, You in Midair, directed by Julie Akers. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, Fertile Ground is a festival hosted annually here in Portland, which features new works typically presented for the first time. Dana, how was the workshop process for you?
Fantastic. And when I first decided to do this solo show, I hadn't been doing theater for a long time. I had gone back to school and was being a therapist. And then my husband, Benson, had a very bad accident. So I... bike accident, I closed my practice and started writing, and decided 2 years ago that I was going to do this solo show, and I realized that I was not part of a community. And I understood how important that was, so I immediately looked up PDX Playwrights, which I had known about. I'm sure there are other groups, but it's a playwriting group, and they meet every 2 weeks. And I went to them, and I joined them. It was fabulous, and they read somebody's play every time. And I met people and got encouraged. And then they said, well, there's this thing called Fertile Ground, you know, so won't you submit a play? So I read part of it to them, and they were very enthusiastic. And then I had a wonderful director and got to do it. The cool thing about Fertile Ground is it's uncurated. So there's this wonderful feeling of freedom. You can do anything you want. And I think that was great. I loved it. That was wonderful.
Yeah, they hand over the keys and say,
here you go. Good luck to you.
So tell us about your journey over the years towards writing and producing the show. Would you say that this process has been transformative for you?
Well, it's not over yet. I'll let you know.
Still got your hands in the fire.
Got
there.
My hands in the fire. We'll see what happens. I think so. I think so. It it brings Rebecca very close, and I really like that. And of course, you can't have the joy without the sorrow, and that's I'm going to write a book called The Particle Theory of Happiness, okay? Because you got to experience the bad bits, but just hang on, because then some good bits will come. And really enjoy the good bits, because they're going to go and the bad bits will come. So anyway, I don't know where I was going with that.
I like to tell when I hate, I'm sorry to make this about us, but I feel like we're just
I love it. I was hoping it would.
And I just, my best friend left behind this young man who's was desperately, it's his first love.
Mm.
And I've just kind of adopted him a bit. Mm. We spent a lot of time together, and I told him, I was like, you know, I call it the onion. You know, if you peel an onion, it's nice and rich and juicy, and if you let it sit out for a while, it molds over again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you just peel away one piece of skin at a time, eventually the onion will bleed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for me, it reminds me of how fragile we are, and how, you know, you think you're okay one day, and then you're not, or there's a piece of work that you put up on stage that opens up this channel you didn't ask for, but mm-hmm. it's, but you've gotta, you've, I mean, I think my therapist said that. It's like, you have to live through, you have to feel this, you have mm-hmm. to process these feelings, and
you said, what's it been like over the years? And I think at the beginning there was this searing anguish, and you can't believe that it's ever going to change, and in a way you don't want it to change, because if it got muted, you would be disloyal. That's how I felt at the beginning. And people said, oh, it's going to get softer. And I said, yeah, well, maybe for you, but not for me. And of course it did. It's been 28 years, and it is softer. There are other sorrows, like we don't have the grandchildren we would have loved to have, but that initial anguish is not quite as sharp, and I think it does get sublimated in other things you do, and then, as you say, sometimes it just reappears. There it is, gulp.
Do you have any relationships with other families or parents that have dealt with this type
Yes.
of...
Yes. The first year, we went to Parents of Murdered Children, and it was great. It was just great. There was nothing tying all of us together but the fact that we had lost somebody, and it wasn't just for Parents of Murdered Children, it was anybody who lost somebody to murder. And being around them and getting reassurance that you're not crazy because you're driving down the street and you can't remember, you wake up and you think, wait a minute, where am I and where am I going? They say, that's normal. That if that's not happening, you're not normal. That should happen. And we could engage in gallows humor that nobody else would understand. And it was great, yeah. And, so, of course, as we say, you never know what people are walking around with. You just don't know. Somebody's walking down the street. You don't know what they're carrying with them.
You don't know what they're carrying with them, like psychologically, yeah. emotionally,
yeah.
and physically.
Yeah, yeah, loss. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
So what can you tell us about the show? What do you hope for your audiences to get out of this experience?
Well, I'm shallow, so I hope they're entertained first. Goal.
You're definitely an actor.
I really do want them to be entertained, and I dare to hope that, you know, they laugh, and because there's funny stuff, and there's I do a lot of dancing. That just appeared in there, and that I hope. I don't dare speak for them. I'm giving them this, and I hope they receive it, and maybe if they feel enlarged or I even to use the word inspired, you know, I don't want to be phony, but if they feel inspired to do or think something different the next day, maybe that would be a good thing.
So will you be having any post-show discussions or talkbacks at all?
You know, we haven't decided that. We did at Fertile Ground, and it was very interesting. So we might. Mm-hmm.
But do you have any idea what that focus might possibly be? So most people, it's like, well, what do you think about the show? Or like some plays they like to talk about. Because I imagine some things are going to come up that could spark some really big community discussions about... gun control, about one parent that has lost a child, and I feel like people when they see shows that we do, they there's it can just be a word or a moment, something they take home with them. They sometimes they like to air that out sometimes. I don't know if that was something you were considering.
Let's see. What were some of the things people said? Well, a lot of it was technical. The other cool thing about Fertile Ground is it's essentially, it was just me on a stage. There was no lighting. There was no sound. And I said, you know, we're hoping to put on a fuller production. And people said, no, don't do that. And I couldn't understand. They said, no, don't add anything. We just want you on the stage. I said, well, but design. We want design elements. We want sound and light. So that was an interesting thing. I never did quite understand where they were coming from.
Well, Portland loves minimalist theater.
Is that what it is? Oh, thank you for explaining to me.
If you've got a black box and a stool and a chair and a light, that's... They just, honestly, I've seen some amazing things happen.
Oh, sure.
With just like watching some person not even move 2 feet on a stage.
Oh,
it's
sure.
Amazing.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, now I'm trying to think back. Why did we expand it? My director has a very strong sense of design and theater, and she said it would just be so much fun to deepen it and richen it. And then I went out and got this fabulous creative crew. Tim Stapleton has this amazing white set.
Oh,
and
Tim.
Tim? So I feel very happy about all of this. We have a wonderful sound designer, Phil Johnson.
That's what I love about theater. It's one, in my opinion, it's one of the most collaborative art forms that there is. You know, my job today is to write and perform this. Can you guys, you know, and you have people, it sparks the imagination, the words and the...
Yes, and I was coming from tortured literary stuff where I was sitting and you know, writing all by myself, and I might take a workshop or something, but it has been wonderful. And our lighting designer lives in L.A., so I haven't really seen what she's going to come up with, but just to have the sound design is so... It's so luxurious. It's not just me on the stage. I've got sound and something else to react to besides imaginary stuff.
Right. So once again, for those that are just now joining us, you are listening to Stage and Studio. I'm James Dixon, and joining us today is our special guest, Dana Schaefer, writer and actress for her one-woman show, You in Midair, directed by Julie Akers. So tell me, so this play was once named, was it
Little Jezebel. And you know, I had to come up with something fast for Fertile Ground because a deadline was fast approaching, and I'm not sure how I know how I got it. An Italian waiter called Rebecca La Mia Piccola Isabel, which means my little Jezebel, and I thought it was so cute. So I thought, oh, well, that's meaningful, I'll use that. But people hated it. They thought I was calling her a loose woman. Jezebel, did you have that association? I don't. I wasn't raised with the Bible. Maybe if I... Yep, oh, somebody here is shaking her head very vigorously. All her curls are jiggling.
I was
jiggling.
Thinking it, and she's... I was like,
Yeah.
It does sound... initially, it sounds that way, but everything we do is subjective, right?
Absolutely.
So,
that's
right. Like, I was reluctant to say yes because it's yours. You created it. If that's what you want it to be, then... You know, it's just like, hey, well, that's what it is. Well, show me how that works. You know, that's what we do in theater.
I didn't have the guts. Okay, you're braver than me. And it was so universally hated. I finally thought, okay, just leave me alone. I'll change it. And it has never been easy to find a title for this. I'm not sure why.
I wonder, I'm just guessing. I'm just wondering how many mothers started to connect with that. And maybe, I mean, is it some kind of like
to the
association?
Word Jezebel?
Jezebel or like, I mean, I think of the Bible. I'm a preacher's son. Like,
are you?
Yeah.
And so Jezebel does sound like a loose woman, a harlot to
that's,
you?
That's what.
But
that's
you know, what... every morning in my inbox, I get Jezebel's is a daily magazine I get. And so I'm used to, I guess I'm desensitized. I don't know.
Right.
It was interesting.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
So what, I mean, tell us more about this show. So what's... Is it more of a drama? Is it a comedy? Is it more introspective? Like, what can people expect, or do you want to surprise them? Like, what?
Oh, I think I say we because now that I've got this crew, take them to different places in the world and show them what life was like with Rebecca and then what it was like after Rebecca. And there's a lot of comedy. Again, the particle theory of happiness, you can't have the misery without the joy. And I think life is tragic and hilarious, so there you go.
So I'm going to shift gears just a little bit. Sure. So there are many hot topics right now, especially considering our current political climate. Gun control being one amongst many, which has been ongoing for years now. Could you tell us more about your gun control lobbying efforts? I'm actually guessing that's what you meant by lobbying, correct?
Is that right? Yes, that is it. That is it. Yeah. You know, one of the first things I said to a reporter, excuse me, was, I think she said, do you regret letting Rebecca go to New York or something? Do I regret something? I said, no, the only thing I regret is that somebody sold a crazy person a gun. Well, that got into the New York Times in an editorial. And the next thing I knew, people were saying, so, are you going to be lobbying for gun control? And I thought, well, okay. So I lobbied. Multnomah County wanted to enact a law that said it would not be okay to have an assault weapon in the streets. Like, we need a law for that. So I went down to the courthouse and I testified. And as, you know, it helps being a little bit of a dingbat, I gotta say. Even with grief, having a dingbat streak helps. Anyway, I was ardently, you know, talking about the importance of not letting guns get into the wrong hands. And all of a sudden I heard a big crowd booing. And I wondered who they were booing. And later I realized they were booing me. And it was part of the gun lobby booing me. You're shaking your, nodding your head like, well, of course. It didn't occur to me they were booing me.
Right.
So
I asked this question on purpose because it's interesting. It's very interesting. Now, you know, since Oregon laws, we love our guns.
Yep, we do.
And I, you know, after my friend died, I strongly considered it.
Getting a gun to protect yourself?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I felt so guilty about it because I know what they do to people, yeah. You know? And I do a lot of equity work. So it's just like, then I started thinking about, I was like, well, why do I want one? I want to feel safe. Well, what else would make me feel safe, you know? And not to make this about me, but being a queer black male, there's a lot of things that I fear on a daily basis.
I can understand.
And I mean, from the police to all the Nazi stuff that's happening.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So I was just like, yes, maybe I want one. Maybe I do. And you go down there and you pick out this thing that kills people. And I remember going through this process and I'm like, it's so easy.
Oh, ridiculously
easy. It's so easy. Are you crazy? No. Do you have any, as long as no one has a restraining order against you and you don't have a felony.
Yeah.
You're in, you know? It's like, oh, you're good. Give us a stamp. And it's just like, I was grateful because I did purchase one.
You
it's
did.
In my home. I did.
Is that right?
I did. And I.
And what's that feel like? Do you feel safe?
I do. But I also, but there's another layer because it's in my home. I have it locked in a safe.
Well, that's the
I
other thing.
I care about the safety of my other people around
then
me.
Then you're required to babysit it and not let it get in the wrong hands and keep it locked up. It's a responsibility,
yeah.
Right?
And I guess I bring this up because when you are testifying and those people booed you, all I can think about is they are more concerned about having their guns. I want my guns without
Absolutely.
Thinking about
Absolutely.
How people are affected by all of this.
Well, and I'm not usually even-handed and open-minded, but it is cultural. And if you grow up with guns, that is part of your culture. And if somebody tries to take them away, they are attacking your culture. And I understand that. I do understand that. Anyway, so I testified at Multnomah County, got booed, and then went to Salem. I had a wonderful time in Salem. And got to know all the legislative aides, and I co-founded Oregonians Against Gun Violence, and we had put together a bill, and one of the things it did was close the gun show loophole, oh, ha, ha, forget about it. And I dragged that thing all over Salem. Of course, it didn't go anywhere. And then I went to Washington, D.C., and lobbied for the Brady Bill, which was an omnibus bill, but it had some gun control. I just hate that phrase. It's so, anyway, some sensible gun laws built into it, like a waiting period and a background check. Is that so much to ask? Mm-hmm. And I delivered 3 yes votes on it, but a fat lot of good that did.
It's good to hear you say that because I, you know, even working here, I worked in a newsroom for about a couple years back doing a lot of news reports. And the way we talk about things as media or as it affects it, you know, when we talk about insurgents, when we're really talking about, when we talk about control, control, restrictions, and
it's fighting words. It's fighting words. And there was somebody did a study that I read a long time ago where if you ask people, anybody on the street, do you believe that guns should be kept out of the hands of children? They say, oh, yes, absolutely. Do you think they should be kept in a safe? Yes, absolutely. Do you think people with a severe psychiatric disorder should be kept from having guns? Oh, yes, absolutely. Do you believe in gun control? No! That's a fact. I'm not sure what you call that, but if there's a blanket rubric, people will react to it. But if you ask the details, they might well agree with you. So I think that's where lobbying comes in. You have to.
And everything in our lives is marketed to us.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
Fear, everything's marketed
to
us.
That's right.
So where can we buy tickets for the show?
Brown paper tickets. And also youandmidair.com. And the designer who put together the website got some clips of Rebecca and my sister Sam. They're so cute. I just love that they're on there. So it's kind of a fun place to go and buy tickets.
And on Brown Paper Tickets, they just go and they search for You and Midair, and that works that way as well?
Yep, that's right.
Awesome. So you are listening to Stage and Studio, and we have been talking to special guest, writer, teacher, therapist, lobbyist, and actress.
Ooh.
Dana Schaefer, and the Portland debut of her one-woman show, You in Midair, directed by Julie Akers. You in Midair opens this coming Thursday, October 5th, and runs through October 15th. These performances will be hosted at the new Expressive Works Theater located at 810 Southeast Belmont Street, right here in Portland. For ticket information, visit www.brownpapertickets.com and search for You in Midair, or you can go to youinmidair.com. Dana, a tremendous thanks to you for joining us today. We wish you much success with the show.
Thank you. Thank
and
you
happy
so
opening.
Much.
It's been really great talking
you.
To you.
I
and
appreciate
connecting
it.
With you.
It's been enlarging. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Today's intro and outro music was brought to you by Barbara Lush and Bobby Torres from their CD album, Surprisingly Good for You. That music will be featured in Dana Schaefer's show. If you missed any of this interview, you can listen online later today at kboo.fm/stageandstudio. You can also get post events or get previews by joining our Facebook page. And that's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to our engineer, Judy Feistel. Till next week, I'm James Dixon with Stage and Studio. Thanks for listening.